It's not the AI writing the malware. It's actually more in the prompt the individual is using to get the AI to make the malware better. So I don't think it's sentient either. I don't think we're going to have a HAL 9000 situation or a Skynet situation come up anytime in probably my lifetime anyway.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where we break down the most interesting stories in the field with the help of our panel of experts. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and joining me today, Claire Nunez, Creative Director, IBM X-Force Cyber Range, Austin Zeisel, Threat Intelligence Consultant, and valiantly fighting an illness to be here, Dave Bales, X-Force Incident Command and part of the Not the Situation Room podcast. Thank you all for joining me. This week's stories, we're going to be talking about some hackers who are stealing real-world cargo, a time-delayed malware, the AI malware versus AI slop debate, the Louvre's password, which I'm sure you've all heard about. But first, I want to get into the OT-IT patching gap. Now, according to a new set of benchmarks from the IBM Institute for Business Value, OT patching rates lag pretty significantly behind IT patching rates. So, for example, the critical high vulnerability patching rates in IT are about 90% in the median. For OT, it's 80%. So there's a 10 percentage point gap right there. When it comes to medium vulnerabilities, the gap's even bigger. You've got 82% in IT versus 70% in OT. And this comes at the same time that hackers are increasingly taking aim at industrial control systems in critical sectors like water, energy, and agriculture. These attacks can lead to some pretty serious safety issues, right? We've seen things like hackers getting in and adjusting the chemicals used in water treatments that could potentially poison people. So these attacks are all enabled by the kind of IT-OT merger, right? The idea that more and more OT systems are now internet-enabled and they're part of the enterprise network, and that means they're exposed to these kinds of things. So I want to ask, you know, if we're bringing OT into IT, how come our patching practices haven't caught up? Is there something wrong with our approach to this merger? And I want to throw it to you first, Dave. What do you think's going on here?
OT typically tends to be offline, and I think that the problem with patching OT is that someone actually has to get up from their desk and physically walk over and patch the OT systems. In a perfect world, you wouldn't have to do that, but then they'd be online and they'd be even more susceptible to attacks from threat actors. So I think it's really just a matter of having to actually visit each OT system and patch it from there.
That makes sense. Austin, any thoughts to add?
Yeah, going off what Dave just said, so within OT environments, they often prioritize that uptime and safety over rapid patching and speed, unlike IT systems. So many of those OT systems can't simply just be rebooted or updated without really disrupting critical operations. And I think that operational mindset has created really a predictable window of exposure that a lot of these adversaries have been exploiting.
Absolutely. Claire, your thoughts?
Yeah, so OT, as Dave mentioned, is a lot harder to go in and patch and make changes to. Another issue with a lot of the infrastructure, especially in the United States, is it is old. It's very old. We see that we see the impacts not just in terms of cybersecurity, but also weather. So a lot of our systems are very susceptible to weather. You see the issues from like the Texas snowstorms a couple years back. So, these systems are very delicate and we don't always, we prioritize availability over actually ensuring that they're secure in every sense. So physically secure, cyber secure. It's not easy to go in and take care of these operational systems. It's also very expensive. There are also OT platforms that kind of help with security, but a lot of organizations don't actually necessarily use them. So it is a little bit scary to think about too, and not to be kind of like a doomsdayer, but like everybody should have an alternate plan in the case of that these systems, you know, go down if for whatever reason. So, but it is really scary. And I think, Matt, the example you shared was lye being shared, added to the water on accident. There's also been cases of pressure changing. So there's a lot of kind of ways that threat actors can manipulate the power grids and the water systems. And it's just something that not everybody is super cognizant of because they're not necessarily thinking about the security that goes into these different systems that we use every day.
And a lot of these programmable logic controllers are 20, 30 years old too. Because like Claire and Austin both said, it's not as easy as just patching these things and having the uptime stay stable. Once you take these down, it takes a while for them to go down and then come back up. So patching them is probably lower on the priority scale than, say, getting the lye out of the water.
And turning it off doesn't mean just turning off one element. You're likely turning off several different elements, and you have to patch one, and you have to patch another, and then you have to make sure they're still connected to your IT, and the IT-OT connection is working properly. So it's not as easy as just turning something off to fix it and turning it back on. This impacts all kinds of businesses, not just, you know, us on a human level for needing energy and water and all that kind of stuff. Like, a bank cannot operate its data centers if it doesn't have any power. So I think a lot of other businesses aren't necessarily fully thinking about the OT impact on their own organizations as well.
Yeah, I think those are some really good points that you folks bring up, especially around how it's a lot more complicated to do some of these patches, do some of these security fixes for OT than some of these other, than your average IT system. And Claire, you even said that, you know, you brought up the point that a lot of this stuff is also not having maybe the physical maintenance that it needs or those kinds of security issues. And so that brings me to, maybe this is a naive question for, you know, because I'm not somebody who's in this realm, but, you know, is it just the case then that we have to accept this level of risk, that this is just kind of, it comes with OT, this is just what it's like, the patching will always be less than IT, or I don't know, could we ever get to a point, could we change things where we can actually maybe make these systems a little more secure, get those investments in without necessarily harming economic activity, which I understand is a huge question. But I'll ask Austin. Austin, you have any thoughts? Are we just kind of doomed to accept this level of risk?
It comes down to a matter of prioritizing those security measures. And that first begins with network segmentation and passive monitoring. Those are really critical, especially in OT environments, but they're really only half the story, I think. Leaders in that space must also pair those controls with stronger patch governance, because we just talked about earlier how important that patching is. Also accountability with vendors, because with ICS systems, OT, you have so many different third parties and supply chain vendors involved. So true OT specific incident response planning is really critical here. Not just repurposing it from, you know, outdated IT playbooks.
I like that a lot. You need a very specific approach to this kind of thing. You know, we might be making OT and IT look similar in a lot of ways, but they're still very different systems and you need a very different approach. And Claire, I just wanted to ask you, another point that you had brought up was about how these OT systems are often entangled in so many other systems. And that's part of what makes it so complicated when it comes to patching them. You're not just shutting down like one machine. You can shut down like a whole, you know, production facility basically to do this. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how that feeds into our ability to maybe someday get this, you know, problem under control.
I think it plays into it if we're only thinking about today. And I don't think that's the best way of looking at resiliency for these systems, especially, again, we are looking at multiple challenges in terms of cybersecurity, physical security from natural disasters and people sneaking into these locations and such. And I think, you know, the natural reality is that most organizations are just thinking about, you know, the near term in terms of some of these systems because the investment is so large. But the investment will be larger if you have to take your plants or your grids down for a very long time and you have constituents who are angry, citizens who are angry, or you can't produce at all. For some organizations, the cost of not being able to produce is in the millions per day. It's kind of thinking, okay, if we have to take down our site for 24 hours, that's going to cost us this much, plus the cost of changing everything within there, versus being down for potentially 2 weeks, 3 weeks because of some kind of damage. And then on top of that, also having to replace everything because it's either ruined by, like, you know, loss of backups or something, or like a natural disaster. So it's doing some cost-benefit analysis, and I don't know if everybody's necessarily doing it because it's very expensive no matter what. It's just one much larger price point than the other.
How would everyone feel if they just, for just the smallest example, lost water pressure for a couple of hours? People are going to complain about that.
People will complain.
Just water pressure. Forget the lye, forget the fluoride, forget turning the water off. Just lose water pressure for a couple of hours and listen to your neighbors all start coming out into the middle of the street and talking about the fact that there's no water pressure.
I was going to say, Dave, literally like a year ago, that happened in my neighborhood. And you're right. It's just water pressure. We're not even talking about something that's like life or death. It's just everyone's suddenly out in the streets. Is your water pressure working? Is your water working? Is it just my water? And yeah, so, you know, that does, you're right. That complicates things even more, you know? I guess we'll round out the segment by saying that I feel bad for the folks who have to make these decisions because Lord knows I couldn't make them. Let's move on to the next story. Hackers steal real-world cargo. Now, speaking of cyber attacks that have some very material consequences, Proofpoint reported last week on a sophisticated cybercrime ring that's targeting freight companies to steal their cargo. Now, a real quick summary of how freight companies connect with carriers might be in order for those who aren't familiar with it. They tend to use a kind of marketplace system, right? So a freight company comes in and says, hey, we have this load. Carriers come and say, hey, we can carry it for this amount. They make a deal. It works that way. The way the cyber attack operates is that first the hackers get in there and they impersonate a freight company and say they have a fake load. Carrier comes and bids on it. They use that opportunity to compromise the carrier's account, and then they act as the carrier, and they bid on real loads and say, hey, we can take this job. When they secure the job, they send their own trucks over to pick up the load and take it, and of course, it never makes it to its final destination. The brazenness of this really struck me, which is why I wanted to kind of bring it up and see how folks feel about it. Claire, let me start with you. Any initial reactions to this cyber attack?
I kind of think about it in terms of, like, that's such a mixed bag where you're just stealing people's Amazon packages. Like, you can either get a computer or you're getting just soap or something. I guess with cargo, initially I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, how do you get rid of all of that cargo that's within? But I thought it was just an interesting overall concept where it's just like you're reselling these items. And you have to be really organized to take on that kind of level of crime and to kind of figure out what you're going to do with all those shipments as well. When I was reading kind of the Reddit thread that you sent over, Matt, about the person whose organization had faced this, it came down to these people receiving an email saying you have to do this for a specific order, and then they input their information, and that's kind of how the threat actor got in. And it's like, of course, in my mind, it came down to somebody rushing and clicking a link they shouldn't have. And I wonder how much more common this is than reported, because shipping is now like everything has to be shipped within 2 days kind of thing. So there's probably just a tremendous sense of pressure on these people that, like, sending them a phishing email like that would definitely get them to act. So I wasn't surprised seeing that, but it's interesting to see, because sometimes I'm guessing, like, people will get packages delayed and such, and you don't necessarily know about why. And maybe it's because it was actually just lost by somebody in a warehouse, or it was part of a larger cargo cyber crime ring.
Yeah, it is funny, right? It is kind of like a scaled up version of the mail theft ring. I didn't really think about that, but it's extremely obvious. And also, side note, one of my proudest moments was foiling some mail thieves in my neighborhood, but we don't have to talk about that right now.
Good
Dave,
for you.
You were going to say something. Come on in here.
I was. I feel like I'm watching a true life episode of Shipping Wars. I don't know if anyone's ever seen the show.
Yes, I have.
But that's what this feels like. It feels like Shipping Wars, except it's the Old West version of Shipping Wars where they're jumping on trains and stealing things. But no, like Claire was saying, it's, you know, when you start talking about whether or not your package has been lost or whether it's been stolen, I've actually had packages stolen from the truck, not from my doorstep. It will say, oh, well, your package has been delayed and we'll let you know if it doesn't arrive within 2 days, let us know. Well, so these pirates, these thieves, these people that do this, I don't understand what the end goal is aside from making money and making other people miserable. And they do. They make people miserable. That could be a load of diapers for a new grandfather, let's say, or it could be, like Claire said, a computer. Why are they doing this? Because it's easy to do. That's why. The attack numbers have increased year over year, like 2024, I think it was 25-27%. And then projected for this year, it's another 22% increase. I mean, they're going after large transport firms, and it's just a matter of time before they hit an Amazon truck, and then we're all in trouble.
Now, I'm sort of wondering, too, in light of that last story that we were talking about, you know, in terms of the OT systems being attacked, and now we're talking about these cargo theft and getting into the mix, it almost feels to me like our concept of cyber attack needs a little bit of updating. And again, maybe this is just myself and my own projection, but I think cyber attack and that cyber part comes in pretty big, right? You still kind of think this stuff is happening on computers, but it's spilling out into the real world in these very interesting ways for me. And I'm wondering if, I don't know, do other people kind of feel the same thing going on? Or maybe you've been thinking about this much longer than I have. Austin, let me throw it to you. Have any thoughts on this kind of blurring of the lines between real world security, physical security, and cybersecurity?
Yeah, that's an interesting point because, you know, the tides have shifted. You know, we think of cyber attacks as strictly being digital and data oriented, whereas these attacks are having real world physical implications. And I don't think people, at least the general public, fully understand that, especially when there's so many different third parties involved, smaller brokers, multiple carriers within those supply chains. So that creates much more fragility amongst those supply chains in this, you know, logistics and transportation sector.
Absolutely. Claire, any thoughts on your end?
Yeah, in the cyber range, we've increasingly seen clients go from being more focused on the loss of data, which is an awful thing for a lot of us consumers, to more like material impacts of having either impacting shareholders, employees, and again, customers in terms of service availability. So I think it's also a bigger concern for organizations too, where it's like, I will not be able to produce X products and there will be an outage for a certain amount of time. And then all of our customers are going to switch to Y product because it's not available. So I think as a consumer, we also don't care as much about our data being lost because our data has been lost how many times? I'm sure everybody on this call has, like, you know, at least 10 years of data credit monitoring. So, you know, like, I think it's something that organizations are also thinking about because they're scared, because that's more of a like an impact to their business if they can't produce or provide services. And that's going to impact them more. And I think at the end of the day, if you can't, kind of going back to the OT, if you have to pay $2 million to get your site back up and running, and it costs $5 million a day of downtime, you're going to pay the $2 million in ransom. You might not admit it, but you're going to pay it because it's, the cost-benefit analysis. So you're either going to lose X number of customers, and it's going to cost you this much, or, you know, so I think it's just kind of it's a mental shift a lot for businesses, and then consumers were starting to get annoyed by it as well. As it trickles down.
I'm going to age my 50-year-old self here. Back when I got my first computer back in the early 90s, we'll go with that. No one ever thought about the number of IP addresses that we had or had available or whether or not we were going to run out. As our landscape shifts to having computers control everything, and let's be honest, it does, everything is a cyber attack now. So we can't just think of cyber attack as one person attacking a computer. You have to put that, the supply chain, that's a cyber attack. You know, the physical attacks, yeah, those are different, but for the most part, we're looking at cyber attacks on everything. So yeah, our definition definitely needs to be updated for cyber attacks. Right now, it's still the old school definition, and we need to get away from that and towards a more modern definition.
Move on to our next story here, folks. This is malicious packages that drop time-delayed logic bombs. Researchers at Socket identified 9 malicious NuGet packages with hidden logic bombs designed to detonate years after they've been installed and working properly the whole time. So these packages, they do work, they do what they say on the tin, but hidden inside of them are these logic bombs that are set to detonate, go off after 2027 or 2028, depending on what package you're dealing with. And the way they work, kind of their malicious components are that, you know, when you first install them, they will start immediately terminating some processes, but they only do it with a 20% chance because it's designed to kind of make it seem random. Like, it's not related to the package, it's just something crashed. But then the specific kind of code that detonates after a few years is they start silently corrupting write functions, right? And so I just, the thing for me was trying to figure out, what's the point of the time delay? What does the attacker gain? What's the play here? And I want to throw to you, Austin. What do you think about this technique?
Well, first off, I've never even heard of this technique being used, so it's pretty wild that this is going on. But as you're asking, what's the point here? Well, I think it's really about the dependency on time, that because this gives attackers so much dwell time, by the time, say, the payload is triggered, that initial dependency has been forgotten because so much time has passed already. So attackers really aren't thinking in days, weeks, or months. They're thinking in years, and that's where, you know, they're using time to their advantage, and these threats are becoming successful.
It's funny, right? The attackers have the long-term thinking, but we talked quite a bit about how, you know, our organizations don't always have the long-term thinking, right? And when it comes to OT patching, there's a little bit of an asymmetry here that is, you know, I don't know, something to think about. Dave, any thoughts on your end about this technique?
Yeah, so what they're looking for is complacency. How many times have you installed a piece of software and 5 years later, it's still sitting there? Whether you use it or not is irrelevant, but it's still sitting there. I personally probably don't uninstall about 90% of the software that I install. So if I'd have downloaded one of these NuGet packages, in a couple of years, I'm going to have a logic bomb go off on my machine because I just don't do it. I don't uninstall things. And I think that's what these attackers are counting on. They're going to get these packages installed. They've been downloaded, 9,500 times? So 9,500 people who haven't read this story are going to be in for a very big surprise come September of 27 and October of 28.
That's a really good point. I mean, I'm looking at my own desktop right now. It is littered with things I've downloaded that I haven't touched in forever. And you're right. I don't bother to, you know, get rid of them. You know, storage isn't really a problem anymore. So you download a thing and you just let it sit there. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Maybe I should delete some apps. Claire, what about you? Any thoughts on your end?
I just think it's smart from a threat actor perspective. It's smart. Most people will forget about things. Most people won't even read that headline and know that there's something they shouldn't have downloaded in whatever they downloaded. So I just think it's really like a innovative way of getting malicious packages on people's devices without them knowing, even though they, at this point, I guess, should know since it's out there. But it's just smart from a threat actor perspective.
Yeah, Austin, I want to come back to you again, because as you had said, right, this is something you hadn't really seen before. This is kind of a new one for you. I'm wondering, do we need to be paranoid about this kind of thing lurking in more packages? You know, do we need to be worried about this? Or do you think, this is one incident, you know, how should we approach this? How should we think about this kind of threat on a scale level? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should prioritize this threat because, again, the threat landscape's always evolving and we're seeing this play out. And so we need to sort of think ahead of the threat actor, because there is some strategic intent here. You know, this is about long-term persistence and also leverage by using time to their advantage. And again, it's not just about stealing data. It's about planting those seeds for future leverage and control, as well as just overall sabotage.
Gotcha. Dave, any thoughts on your end about how a defender should be thinking about this kind of thing?
Typically, I would think that the defenders of databases and industrial controls would be the most concerned about this. After 4 years of a database being populated, a logic bomb going off would wipe it out completely. I mean, now you've got 4 years worth of data that you can play with. Industrial controls, same thing. You've got 4 years worth of data to play with. So you're in for some really big disruptions if we don't get all of these traced, as many as we can, traced to the downloaders and get them off of those systems, because they're probably going to extremely important functions.
Absolutely. No, that's a very good point, and I had neglected to mention, but yeah, these packages target largely database systems and ICSs, and so yeah, they can cause some serious problems there. Let's move on then to the next topic, and this is honestly maybe the one I'm most excited about to ask you folks about today. AI malware or AI slop? Cybersecurity researchers are increasingly pushing back against some of the breathless and mildly apocalyptic reports of AI-powered malware that we've seen come out. And in the last week, two big instances happened that made me want to bring this before you folks today. The first was that Google started talking about an experimental malware it found called PromptFlux, which can interact with Gemini's API to regularly request rewrites to its code with the intent of evading detection. But as cybersecurity researcher Marcus Hutchins points out, this self-modification function was commented out in the code, so it wasn't even actually active. And even if it were, it probably wouldn't operate all that seamlessly. Just because it's requesting, you know, code rewrites doesn't mean those rewrites are actually going to evade any detection system, or they might not even work. The other thing that happened was that there was a widely cited MIT Sloan working paper that came out in the spring, and it claimed that 80% of active ransomware attacks were using AI. It has since been withdrawn after some serious criticism came out regarding the methodology, with researchers wondering how the authors were able to definitively say AI was involved in any of these attacks. So my question is, have we lost the plot when it comes to these AI-powered threats? You know, are we getting a little ahead of ourselves with the way we talk about these things? Dave, what are your thoughts here?
So there are built-in protections in all the AI models for the public iterations of these AI models that keep you from putting your code in and getting some more malicious code out. However, you can take the training wheels off of these and put your own instance in, and now you've got your own little personal AI bot who is willing to do whatever you want. And as long as we talked about this on the other show, once you start removing the gates, you start allowing more things to happen. We're going to see this more and more. The research paper from MIT notwithstanding, I mean, they did make some grandiose claims. But you are going to see AI malware come into existence, and it's going to be dangerous, and it's going to be good, and it's going to be, you know, a way for adversaries to get into systems that they wouldn't normally have the skill set to get into. But AI absolutely has the skill set to do whatever it needs to do, programmed by humans.
It's a lovely partnership, you know? Austin, your thoughts on this kind of subject. Do you think we are maybe a little sensational about this, or do you think this kind of thing is something to be worried about right now?
I mean, I think AI, you know, the idea of AI being fully autonomous, self-evolving malware is sort of in the realm of science fiction than reality, because at the end of the day, AI is a tool created by humans, and it's really a reflection of us. It's not independent of human nature. Perhaps that day will come, but I think for now, that isn't fully operational. You know, I don't think AI is going to become conscious and self-aware. So I don't really see a 2001 Space Odyssey scenario playing out, but maybe I'm just being too optimistic.
Yeah, and it's kind of like Dave said, right? The threat necessarily isn't the sentient malware, but it's like if a hacker has their own little, you know, training wheels off a model to help them do things they couldn't do otherwise, right? It's sort of less sensational, but just as dangerous, maybe more dangerous. Claire, your thoughts on this kind of situation?
Yeah, I agree with Austin. I don't think it's something... It is very sci-fi right now, but I do think it would be a mistake to say that threat actors aren't using AI in some capacity. I mean, I mentioned in, like, I think our last episode that I was on, like, threat actors are usually working for organized criminal organizations, so they are also trying to optimize their operations, which probably includes bringing in AI to that. So, I mean, it would be kind of silly for a threat actor to not be using AI to, like, check their code or, you know, to write phishing emails or something. It would just extremely speed up their operations. So I think it's safe to assume that most of them are using AI in some capacity like that. But I don't know if we fully, you know, have gotten to the point of, like, self-evolving malware that is almost like a real, like, biological virus of some kind. I don't think we're there yet. And if we are, I don't know if we'd pick up on it yet, but I don't necessarily think it's, like, something super true yet. But I think a lot of people are, like, forget that AI can be a little scary if you are trying to do prompt injections and trying to evade the safeguards.
I agree that I don't think it's sentient yet, and I don't think that anyone would be foolish enough to think that AI is writing malware itself. It's all human-based. I think it's more code, code embellishment that AI is being used for. Looking at the code that they're putting in, hey, make this better for me. So it's not the AI writing the malware. It's actually more in the prompt that the individual is using to get the AI to make the malware better. So I don't think it's sentient either. I don't think we're going to have a HAL 9000 situation or a Skynet situation come up anytime, and probably my lifetime anyway. But they are using it to make malware better because they do have these sandbox AI instances that allow them to do things that they wouldn't normally be able to do on, say, Gemini or Copilot or ChatGPT or anything else like that.
Yeah, and I want to ask about, you know, something else that I've seen cybersecurity researchers increasingly talk about is that some of this might be a kind of communication issue. And by that, they mean some of the organizations reporting on this malware, they might feel a little, I don't know, motivated to make it seem more impressive than it actually is for, you know, first of all, to get some headlines, to get some clicks, but also because if you're helping to kind of secure AI systems, you might have an investment in making the AI systems look super spooky. So I'm kind of wondering if you folks feel like we might be dealing with partially a communication issue here. Are we just, like, sensationalizing these things too much? Is that what you think is going on? And I'll start with you, Austin. What do you think about that?
This recent report that was, redacted, has definitely been sensationalized, because if a board believes, you know, AI is driving 80% of ransomware, which is the stat they put on the headline, you know, they may start overspending and misallocating resources on AI detection tools, which will also underspend on basic security hygiene like patching, segmentation, and identity and access management. So I think that misallocation of resources can become a massive strategic risk for organizations.
Cool. All right. Well, then we will wrap that section up and move on to our final story of the week.
Oh, my favorite.
The password for the Louvre's video surveillance system was Louvre. By now, we've all heard about the theft of some $100 million worth of jewels from the Louvre. And in the wake of this incident, some news outlets have resurfaced some old reports on the Louvre's security measures, including warnings from the National Cybersecurity Agency about its kind of weak systems and the fact that at one time, at least, the museum's surveillance system password was Louvre. Now, Dave, given that you were so eager to dive into this one, I feel like I should just throw it to you first. Give me your thoughts here. What do you think? What do you think?
Were they thinking? Honestly, password 123 would have been better, you know? And I'm sure they probably tried that and said, wait a minute, let's just go with the most simple thing and let's just see if it's Louvre. And they got in with that. And this was the camera system, right? This wasn't like the password to the Louvre's cybersecurity system. Their security system. It wasn't keeping the jewels safe. It's just the camera system. Just the camera system? Really? I mean, that's a pretty big system there. I mean, this is a building that houses hundreds of billions of dollars worth of priceless, I mean, you can't put a price on it, of priceless items, and they couldn't be bothered to put multi-factor authentication in there. They couldn't be bothered to come up with something that was more than 6 characters long. They couldn't be bothered to put even an exclamation mark at the end of it. Really? Or use some leet speak in there. Yeah, exactly. We need leet speak in there so that at least someone with half a brain would have to use it. No, my son could have probably done this, and he doesn't know anything about computers.
Claire, I wanted to ask you, as somebody who, you know, I know you spend a lot of time working with organizations, training. I'm sure the Louvre is not the only institution that's been guilty of these kinds of lax sort of security processes, and I'm not asking you to tell us about other ones you've seen, but I'm wondering in general, have you noticed these kinds of lax measures in places before? Is this a trend?
I think it's pretty common, but a lot of people will not admit to it. They won't admit that their password is admin or password or whatever the username is. But I think it's very common. But a lot of the people that we have that come through the range probably wouldn't admit that. And these are, you know, executives, so they're not always like the most tech savvy folks either. They probably will not admit that that's their password as well. This is just, I feel like the password and the surveillance camera thing, that's like one of the first things you do when in like a heist movie is like you disable the cameras. So it's like, even if the security association or like the national, whatever coalition it was, didn't say like, you should do something about this. Like if you watch any of those kinds of movies, like, wouldn't you know? But it also, like, to me, this whole thing makes the heist so much less impressive because, I mean, just seeing all of the like lax security measures they had, it's like, anyone could have done it. And I don't want to say anyone could have done it because it's definitely something that's very difficult. But if you look at like the Isabella Stewart Garden like heist in the 90s in Boston, that was just like so well thought out. They still don't know who did it. But it's like with this one, they just kind of went in and they like typed in Louvre and called it a day. And they like they used their drill and they took the jewels and walked away. So, and we didn't find them yet. So it's, as far as I know, I think there's suspects in, but still.
I believe they're still at large, but yeah, they just kind of wore construction uniforms and walked in and nobody really stopped them until they were taking jewels, and at which point it was over, you know? Austin, any thoughts on your end?
This was a matter of not being a technical flaw, but it was a flaw in human behavior and in governance. I mean, that's really the big failure there. Sadly, convenience typically overrides policy when it comes to cybersecurity, and without any accountability, those critical systems remain pretty defenseless, especially with CCTV cameras. So kind of crazy that, you know, an institution as big as the Louvre, world-renowned, thought maybe they were too good for any password hygiene or password rotation.
Also, like, how many people pass through the Louvre a day? I'm sure there are other devices that are just available that you could type that password into and get in. Like, how many people are in there that, you know, could, something's not watched and you could just type it in? It's scary.
You know, I want to end on a constructive note here. So I'm wondering, you look at a situation like this, what kind of lessons do you think we can learn from the Lou's, you know, maybe lax approach to some of their cybersecurity measures? Let's start with you, Claire. Any thoughts there?
There's just so many things that they could have done. I feel like training of their staff as well would have helped too. But I think this whole thing goes back to when we earlier said, or Dave earlier said, like, everything is cyber now. So, like, this wasn't a cyber attack. It was a physical attack, but there is cyber involved. So it's just like, I don't know, have your folks trained, have better passwords. Don't let people just drive up to your institution with, like, a van with a ladder on it and go through the window. I mean, it's just...
Claire has ruined every heist movie I've ever seen now. Ocean's 11 will never be the same.
I'm sorry.
It's true. I was just going to say, you wear a shiny vest and carry a clipboard in to anywhere, and no one bats an eye, right? So it really comes down to the human layer as the first line of defense there.
I like that. I like that it comes down to the human layer. I also just want to say real quick, I do think not letting people drive up to your anything with a ladder is a good, you know, thing to do in general. Like you said, Claire, really great advice to live by. Dave, any thoughts on your end in terms of lessons we can learn here?
The typical answers, you know, practice good password hygiene. I can almost assure you that whomever installed the cameras at the Louvre put the Louvre in as password, and no one ever thought to go back and change it, least of all the people who were in charge of it. They just thought, we'll get to that. And getting to that was the next day, and then it was the day after, and then it was the day after. And I think it just became forgotten. I don't think that the Louvre purposely used the easiest password that they could find. I think it was just forgotten. And I think they probably learned their lesson, and it cost them a few bucks.
I think that's a really good place to end it on. And it is all the time we have for today, folks. So I want to thank you, Dave, Austin, Claire, for sitting here and having this conversation with me. Thank you to the viewers and the listeners. As always, folks, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there, and I don't know, just change your passwords up, man.